Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. Okay, so we are joined this week on the Paleo View by the two awesome skincare experts in this whole primal lifestyle, ancestral health arena. I have known Liz Wolf for almost as long as I have been paleo. We had the pleasure of meeting early on when we were both pretty feisty. Not that we aren't still.
Because you're not feisty anymore.
So I have watched Liz grow and seen her hard work pay off with her skin intervention guide and her book that's coming out, I think in May, Liz, Cave Girl, Modern Cave Girl.
Modern Cave Girl. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to be real honest. We will see on that. I'm being a little bit perfectionist crazy about it. Cause you know, it's not, I'm trying to do a little bit of like a skinny BITCH. I don't know if I can say that on the podcast, but kind of like a rebuttal to that type of thing, but I'm trying to kind of build it in a way that's still respectful of people and their dietary choices. And I'm going to tell you that's been really, really hard. So we're working on it. I may request a little bit of an extension, but it will be out this year. Let's say that.
All right. So Liz's book, Modern Cave Girl, will be out later this year, but her skin intervention guide is out
Which
and
is
available.
Awesome.
Right now,
which is awesome.
Yes, and Sarah and I both think it's awesome, and it's why we requested that we have this show today on specifically skin, hair, and teeth. And we asked Liz's cohort, Trina, who owns and operates Primal Life Organics, which is a health care company, both skin and teeth, and I don't know, hair now too, right? With the dirty poo stuff. So Trina has joined us, and I'm really looking forward to getting some good nuggets from you ladies today.
Thanks. I'm very excited to be here.
Welcome. So I just want to kick it off by saying that I've had a post pending in our blog site for like 6 weeks with a before and after of my Primal Life Organic skincare experience.
Oh, and I'm excited to see that.
No. It's pending. It's in a draft form because every single time that my skin gets clear, like, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to take photos tomorrow. And then I eat a nightshade on accident. It is so frustrating. Which completely has nothing to do with anything that your skincare products could help. But what's amazing is that after I'm exposed, I'm using the Primal Life Organic stuff and it helps it heal more quickly, but then by the time I'm ready to take another photograph, I'm like, oops, I just ate something that I shouldn't have eaten on accident. So, yeah.
Well, I have to admit that I am currently enjoying the intense burning sensation of the banished serum.
Love that.
I accidentally got it on my lips, and oh. I have to, that's like not cool.
Matt kissed my cheek once, and he was like, "Ah, that was no good."
Yeah, no, and it was like I put it on, and then I put some green pasture B beauty balm on top. And I guess I didn't give enough time for the Banish to sort of, and then it was like moving it around my entire face. Note to self.
Yeah. And you have to keep it pretty far from your eyes too, because it will soak in.
Yeah. So good thing is I was just dealing with a couple of little, I get the sort of stereotypical chin stuff. Usually that time of month, every month, but also that's like my classic, if I've eaten something that I shouldn't have, that's where I get a reaction, is acne on my chin. So the good thing was nowhere near my eyes.
That's good. That's
otherwise, cool. Otherwise I'm not sure I would be sounding so chipper right now.
That's okay. When I was making Banished, I have a lot of things that are in production, so to speak, on my vanity. And I at one point had Banished Unlabeled and Boost Unlabeled on my vanity. And I accidentally put Banished on my toothbrush and brushed my teeth. And within like 3 seconds, I realized what I had done. But my gums were on fire.
Oh my gosh.
So it was very interesting. Now I label everything.
Yes. Lesson learned. So, Liz, do you want to talk about your skin intervention guide a little bit for those people who might be still living in a cave and not having checked it out yet?
Hey, that's the place to be, living in a cave. That's definitely better than temporary billeting on an Air Force base. I'll tell you that for sure. So the skin intervention guide was kind of my putting together of everything I know, or as much as I could possibly squeeze in and ask people to read. I think it's something like 200 pages now, with a resource guide as well as an extra easy recipe guide. So it's a beast. But what it is I wanted to put together, well, first of all, kind of rewinding a little bit, I went hippie a couple years back and stopped using shampoo and started cleansing my face with oil and all of these things that, you know, people were really interested in over at my blog, which is cavegirleats.com. And I started to just kind of want to put all that together for folks. But what I realized was that you can do wonderful, crunchy, non-toxic, hippified, unnecessary, chemical-free stuff for the outside of your body, and that's great. But folks that were coming through seeking healing for things like acne, hormonal breakouts, things like that, things that you alluded to as being internal issues, I couldn't tell people to try these things and have them, you know, get their hopes up about being able to heal their acne by just changing their topical routine. So I started looking into, you know, holistic treatments, diet-wise, nutrition-wise, and digestive healing-wise for acne, eczema, psoriasis, rosacea, dermatitis, dandruff, all these things that, you know, a lot of us are just plagued with. And I put together the skin intervention guide, which is basically part one is all about nutrition and superfoods for the skin, which I know you guys are geeked out on as much as I am. Part two is all about healing digestion. And Stacey, I know you talk a lot with people about, you know, how to handle not having a gallbladder. We go through, you know, digestion step by step and, you know, organ by organ. And part three is where I get into the topical stuff. And Trina was so generous to contribute to the guide and bring all of her, you know, world-class knowledge of all these nourishing essential oils and things like that, just the amazing products that she's created. She really added a huge, really kicked up that third section about topical care a notch. So, so grateful to know you, Trina.
I know. Thanks, Liz. It was such a pleasure to write that. It was much more than I expected it to be.
Well, it came together as an absolutely brilliant ebook, and I highly recommend that people check it out. Whether you have skin issues or not, like even if you feel like everything's going great for your skin and hair and teeth and everything, there's still so much to learn in that book. It's pretty good.
Thank you. And if I can just throw in real quick, really, professionally, I'm a nutritional therapy practitioner. So really what this guide is, it's kind of like I structured it like I would a personal consult to help people with these issues. Because as you guys know, like this community is growing and it's so hard to help people, as many people as you want to help, without kind of painting some broad strokes and just putting all the information in one place, whether that's with a guide or a podcast or whatever. So that's kind of where that all sprang from, just so folks know where I'm coming from there.
Yeah, I personally, I knew that you were working on the guide, and I know you well enough to know that it was going to be awesome, whatever you put together, but I really was blown away when I got it. And like you said, it was 200 pages full of really dense, helpful information for a lot of people.
That was actually the first thing when I first opened it, the first thing I saw was the page numbers.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, a guide. Like, I was expecting like a 30-page ebook. I had no idea. I was like, this is like a dictionary for skin.
And it's like, it's not even, I'm adding to it every day. There's going to be an update coming out in the fall. And I'm like, how is this going to work? It's going to be like, you know, Norton's Anthology of English Literature just for, you know, skin disorders. It's crazy, but it's fun.
Well, you know what I like about it is that, and we all know this being paleo, it takes a while to become, I always think it's about a year to 2 year process to actually understand what it is and convert wholly. Mm-hmm. And I think that the guide is incredibly strong because you can refer back to it. The first time you read it, you take away a little bit, but you can go back and reference it. And every single time you take something more out of it, and it just strengthens your belief that paleo really does work.
Oh, thanks, friend.
Yeah, no problem.
So Trina, just to kind of wrap up, I want to make sure that our listeners, it'll be in the show notes, but in case people aren't actually checking out the show notes, I want to make sure everybody is aware that you have generously offered a 15% off discount for your site and Primal Life Organics. People can use the code ThePaleoView, just one word, from today, the 11th through April 15th, 2003, and get 15% off their purchase from your website for probably a lot of the products and stuff that we'll talk about later in the show. And I know personally, I can recommend, I love the face wash and the toner, the Banish serum and the toothpaste. So, and the hand repair, miraculous. Like I know not everybody CrossFits, but I keep that in my CrossFit bag because as soon as I'm done working out, it literally repairs my hand like nothing else I've tried. So I can personally recommend those products. We'll put those in the show notes. Sarah, you said that you're trying
Banished is my entry product into Primal Life Organics. And it's like, you know, when people say, oh my gosh, this product's amazing. And you kind of go like, yeah, right. It's like amazing. So except for the part where it burns for 20 minutes after you put it on. So I'm not a huge fan of that part.
Yeah, just don't put it over your whole face. That's not a good idea.
Yeah, no. Like definitely spot treatment. But yeah, my experience with that I've only been using it for a couple of weeks, but it's been so fantastic that I'm going to be using the promotional code, the PaleoView, to get 15% off an order.
Cool. So, and I know I did not have really good luck with Liz's no poo solution just because I curly hair and the long lead time to getting it to look normal again didn't work for me. But I know, Trina, you've recently come out with the Dirty Poo line. Is that what you're calling it?
Dirty Poo, yes. Dirty Poo.
So I'm stoked to try that out because people have said great things about that. So getting stinkier and more patchouli hippie-based as the day goes on. Although, honestly, I'd like to think that I don't smell. And I've hugged Liz, and I know Liz doesn't smell. So I'm like, all right, if Liz can look that good and smell that good, then I can too. So, cool. Do you have anything else we want to talk to before we get into this hefty Science with Sarah topic?
Oh, no, we should probably get to it.
All right.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So today's topic for Science with Sarah was a special request from Stacey, who sent me, I think, a text message a couple of weeks ago. She's like, hey, for the skin, hair, and teeth show, can we talk about fluoride for Science with Sarah? And I have to admit that forming an opinion on the fluoride issue is something that I've been putting off. And I realized as soon as I started researching this topic for today's show, Why? Because when I went to PubMed, which is the online library of that's run by the National Institutes of Health, that just carries like an index of like all of the medical journals and all of the journal articles that have been published, mostly this century. And I just typed in the word fluoride, and there was over 46,000 journal articles published.
You read that like yesterday, right?
I did not read all of them, although I did read a number of them. So I mean, the question that I am hoping to answer for people today is, what is the role that fluoride has in dental health? So the first thing that I want people to understand is that fluorine is actually an essential trace mineral, and it is believed to have a normal, healthful role in tooth and bone mineralization in the body, and whether or not it has other roles remains unknown. It is a naturally occurring element found in the water, in soil, in plants, and in animals, and it has been a part of the human diet and environment for the history of our evolution. But like all minerals, there is a healthy range. So too little can cause problems and too much can cause problems. And of course, every mineral has its own range, and the biological tolerance for being either, you know, below that range or above that range is different for different minerals. So the effects, of course, are different for different minerals. So the issue with fluoride, there's no sort of understood what might happen if you were fluoride deficient, because that just doesn't, it's really hard to do. The idea that maybe fluoride deficiency could lead to cavities, and maybe fluoride deficiency could lead to some effects on bone, but that's not really well understood. There's a lot more information on what happens with fluoride excess. But what happened in the 1940s was it became recognized that fluoride had a really strong correlation with cavity formation. And what became recognized was that the more fluoride there was in the drinking water, because there naturally is fluoride in drinking water, people who lived in places that naturally had more drinking water tended to have fewer cavities. And that was when fluoride got added to toothpaste, and that was when municipalities started adding fluoride to their watersheds. So since then, there's been 46,000 some odd studies into the effects of fluoride on human health. And what is very, very clear in the medical literature is that fluoride toothpaste does reduce dental cavities, especially in children. The average recommendation is 1,000 parts per million, which is on the strong side for children's toothpastes, actually. And it has been shown to be fairly ineffectual at lower concentrations. So when you get to the sort of 250 parts per million, which might be like a toddler toothpaste, that it doesn't seem to help. And it seems to be more effective in developing teeth. So it seems to be more effective at preventing cavities in children. And it's a little bit more difficult to form strong correlations in adults. So that's the first piece of information. I've got seven of these points. The next part is that excess exposure to fluoride causes something called fluorosis. And in teeth, that causes streaks or permanent stains that go all the way, like the enamel is actually stained, and it is not something that you can use Crest white strips to get rid of. The incidence of dental fluorosis is somewhere around 40%. Now, that can be something that's really super, super subtle, or it can be something that's fairly dramatic. And the risk of developing fluorosis increases with the earlier a fluoride-containing toothpaste is introduced to a child. So it basically, if a child is not spitting out their toothpaste effectively, that dramatically increases the risk of dental fluorosis, which is generally considered a cosmetic problem. In the really advanced cases, it leads to sort of malformations and kind of rough edges in teeth. And in really, really, really advanced cases, it can lead to brittle teeth. But those are like toxin sort of level exposures, not toothpaste and fluoridated water level exposures. So that's why there's a sort of recommendation for a pea-sized amount of toothpaste. That's why you rinse your mouth after you brush. So let's talk a little bit about the other types of fluorosis, because not only can fluorosis happen in teeth, but it can happen in bone. So what's happening with fluorosis is this major component of teeth and bone called calcium hydroxyapatite is replaced with calcium fluorapatite, which is just a very, very slightly different chemical. And so what this appears to be a normal process, but what happens is when you're exposed to excess amounts of fluoride is you get more calcium fluorapatite than you would normally have in your teeth and in your bones. And there's a very small difference between calcium fluorapatite and calcium hydroxyapatite. And that is that fluorapatite is slightly less elastic than hydroxyapatite. So what that means is the higher the concentration of fluorapatite in bones and teeth, the more brittle those bones and teeth are going to be. And it's a small effect. So it takes decades with typical exposures to be able to measure a difference, which is one of the reasons why, you know, toothpastes and fluoridated water were introduced in the 40s, and it was really only in the 90s when people started raising some concerns about this practice. So there is some fairly convincing studies that measure an increase in risk of hip fractures in the elderly associated with fluoridated water concentrations higher than 1 part per million. And they can actually measure that there's more fluoride in the bones of people after hip fractures. It's not that straightforward because there's actually a decrease in risk in vertebrae fractures. And a lot of the safety studies focus on the fact that that might mean that the total number of fractures is not different. So that could reflect a different way that the calcium fluorapatite is deposited in the, hip or the femur compared to vertebrae. It's really unknown why some bones seem to be strengthened by it and other bones seem to be weakened by it. And it's important to sort of understand that there's a real difference here. We're sort of talking about two different things. We're talking about fluoride in toothpaste and fluoride in water. So fluoride in toothpaste has been shown to reduce cavities, but fluoride in water actually hasn't. When you look at the countries that add fluoride to their water versus the countries that don't, and you look at the rate of cavities over the last 50 years, the rate of cavities has been falling dramatically, whether there's fluoridated water or not, in across the board, across all countries. And that's probably because applying the fluoride directly to your teeth is a much stronger effect than drinking it. But that fluoride in the water is probably what is causing fluorosis. So it's that sort of like that extra intake of fluoride. So for example, since 1950, there has been a roughly 4 times increase in dental fluorosis in children. So in 1950, it was measured at 10% in children. And in 2000, it was measured at 41% in 12 to 15 year olds. So that's a fairly dramatic increase in 50 years. And that's not just fluoridated water, because I don't want to get people all freaked out about tap water. That's because of how pervasive this sort of extra fluoride is in our societies now. It has a strong correlation with the use of pesticides, and it's concentrated in processed foods because of where water is used in the the formation of those foods. In addition to toothpaste, in addition to introducing fluoridated toothpaste earlier and perhaps not being, you know, as not being warned against, you know, making sure that your kids spit out the toothpaste and don't swallow it. And plus, on top of the naturally occurring fluoride that we would get exposed to. So there's one other complicating factor, and that is that even though the normal role for fluoride is understood to be predominantly in bone and dental health, that there are some organs in the body in which fluoride appears to accumulate and or have an effect. And two that I wanted to mention that are a little bit better understood is the effect of fluoride on the thyroid gland. You'll read a lot of blogs that say that drinking fluoridated water causes hypothyroidism, and that's not true. And it's not anywhere near as simple as that. Thyroid issues are predominantly caused by iodine, which is another mineral that is supposed to be in a healthy range, either being deficient or in excess. So when you don't have enough iodine, or when you have way too much, that's when you tend to have hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism. Those conditions, as a result of iodine not being in a normal range, are exaggerated if there's excess fluoride. So you need both excess fluoride and iodine being wonky in order to have those thyroid effects. The other organ that I wanted to talk about the effect of fluoride on is the pineal gland. The pineal gland is a small gland in your brain that is the producer of melatonin, which is the sleep hormone, and it's a very, very important circadian rhythm hormone. And there are all kinds of there's a really strong association with melatonin dysregulation and disease. And so this is why we talk about so often, you know, sleep, spend time outside. All of those recommendations are about protecting your melatonin production. So there is some evidence that fluoride accumulates in the pineal gland as people age, and that an increase in fluoride in the pineal gland is associated with reduced levels of melatonin. And this may be one of the reasons why melatonin production decreases in the elderly. So I want to emphasize that these effects take a long time to build up. So this may explain some of the effects that we see in elderly people. At the rates of which water is typically fluoridated, and depending on exactly what your oral hygiene sort of routines are. And this is why there's so much controversy about fluoride. So this is why government regulators are able to say it's completely safe, because these correlations take so long to show up, and there's still so much that is, you know, one study will contradict another study. There's enough questions remaining about the long-term effects of fluoride in health to be able to, for government people to say it's safe. And then there's just as many studies to show that there's reasons for concern for, you know, certain websites and blogs to have these sort of anti-fluoride campaigns. So that's why there's so much division, is because there's quite a lot of questions that are left unanswered. But I want to, again, say that it is clear that fluoride in toothpaste does prevent cavities. So the more accurate question might be, because there's maybe some reasons to be concerned about fluoride exposure, I don't want people to start freaking out and try and remove all of the fluoride from their environments, because fluorine is an essential mineral, and I don't want people to freak out. But you know, maybe taking some small steps to reduce fluorine exposure could be helpful in terms of long-term health. And so are there other options in terms of toothpaste that can have the same effect? And I think that's like really the most important point. And so there's actually a fairly wide range of other mineralizing agents that are being studied. There are two that are really worth mentioning that are currently available in commercial products. One is called amorphous calcium phosphate. It used to be in a toothpaste called Enamelon, which isn't available anymore. It's been repackaged in Arm & Hammer Enamel Care, which also contains fluoride. But for somebody who's having really intense issues with their teeth, with their and with their enamel and with cavities, that might be an option to consider. The other one that I find actually more exciting is called the brand name is called Novamin. The chemical is actually calcium sodium phosphosilicate, and it's also called Bioactive Glass. It is the active ingredient in Dr. Collins Restore toothpaste, and there's at least 10 other toothpastes. Novamin actually has, like, there's a brand name, Novamin toothpaste. But those are toothpastes that are fluoride-free. And in studies that have gone head-to-head with Bioactive Glass and with fluoride toothpaste, they've actually shown that the Bioactive Glass is better at remineralizing teeth, quite a substantial difference. And it's also better for gum health. So if you're concerned about fluoride in your environment, a really simple thing to do is to change your toothpaste. And there are actually good options available that will help with preventing cavities and also remineralizing teeth once cavities start to form. But without increasing your risk of developing fluorosis. So I hope that wasn't, that was a lot of science. That was a big one.
So can I just have a couple of clarifying questions, mm-hmm. and then I want to hear from Trina on what kind of went into her remineralizing toothpaste, which I'm using and I'm hoping is doing magic. I don't know. But so you referred to fluorine and fluoride, and I'm assuming that that's the difference between the natural occurring mineral and then the man-made product that we're adding to things.
So what the difference really is that fluorine is a molecule and fluoride is the ion or atom. Fluoride has a negative charge, and it's more reactive. In terms of what is naturally found in water and soil, it's a little bit different than what is put into water and what is put into toothpaste, because in order, so fluoride is like what is actually bioactive. But when they put it in water, they put sodium fluoride, I'm pretty sure. And sodium fluoride is the active ingredient in rat poison. That doesn't mean that they're putting rat poison in the water. Like it's really hard to say that. But it's when you dissociate them, you've got the sodium and then you've got the fluoride. And I think that's, some people think that that's really what the difference is. I, from my understanding from the literature, it's not so much that it like in it's going to be still bound to a mineral. That's still how it's going to get into the body in how it's sort of naturally found in soil. It's still going to become fluoride bound with something. I think it's really comes down to dose. You know, we're talking about, like fluoride is just it's just an atom. It's just an element. So it's, or fluorine is the element. Fluoride is the ion. So I don't think that it's necessarily like a man-made versus natural made. This is a really rambly way to say it's about dose. It's about how much you're getting, not about the form. There's some concern that the fluoride form might be more easily absorbed than fluorine, but I don't think that that's been really conclusively studied.
Trina and Liz, you guys have thoughts on what kind of you've looked into and what some of the products or natural stuff that you're using as a replacement for fluoride or just in general?
With my Dirty Mouth Primal Tooth Powder, yes, it's completely different than your standard commercial toothpaste. First of all, it's a powder. And I just want to mention that our saliva is influenced by the foods that we eat and the bacteria that's present in our mouth. And typically, our mouth carries a very acidic pH. And as Sarah mentioned, the enamel is composed of numerous minerals, one of those being the hydroxyapatite, but also of calcium and phosphate. But the acidic environment, which is a pH less than 7, can disrupt the enamel and weaken the tooth, and that can cause the demineralization, which then causes your weak teeth and any kind of cavities forming. So what I did was develop a tooth powder that actually has more of an alkaline pH, using clay and like primal dirt clays and baking soda. And this will help promote tooth remineralization and making them more cavity resistant and possibly healing them and making them stronger. The three types of clays that I use are bentonite clay, white kaolin, and French green clay are all used for different reasons. Bentonite has a very high amount of calcium and potassium. It's a detoxifying agent. It helps to fight gum disease. And it also helps to improve your natural immunity from your body. White kaolin is high in calcium, silica, zinc, and magnesium. It also helps to whiten and polish. The main concern people have is this going to make my teeth dark or not so white? But it really doesn't. And actually, I've had so many people tell me that their teeth have actually whitened without having to use the Crest strips anymore, Crest strips. French green clay is incredible. It actually drinks toxic substances and impurities from the tissues of the body. This all helps your gum tissue as well as your enamel. French green clay is actually contains decomposed plant matter. So it has a slew of trace minerals such as silica, magnesium, calcium, iron, phosphorus, sodium. It has copper, zinc, selenium, cobalt, manganese, and microalgae, kelp, and phytonutrients. And the one thing about French green clay is that it has analgesic and anti-inflammatory properties as well. So if anyone is suffering from any kind of oral problems, cavities, or anything on the gums, this can help with periodontal conditions as well. And then obviously I'm going to add some sort of flavor. I do have a natural flavor for children. I usually recommend the natural or cool orange, but I do have like peppermint and spearmint flavors as well.
Cool. I use the spearmint. I've had, just for what it's worth, my specific interest, and I'm, you know, happy to kind of have a dialogue on this. My specific request came from the fact that I have had a cavity since before I was pregnant with Wesley. And I just kind of avoided, I haven't had a cavity since I was a kid. So I avoided getting anything done to it. And then I was pregnant and they don't want to come near you with a 10-foot pole. And then I was nursing and then I was paleo and I was like, oh, I might be able to remineralize my teeth. I'm not eating as much sugar. And I don't want to deal with the idea of putting, you know, I don't even know what to fill it with. I mean, we've talked before about amalgams and stuff. And so, fortunately for me, the cavity is not bothering me. It's not on a nerve. It's not growing. It's not becoming this huge problem. And I was a little bit afraid to switch toothpaste because I had been using just a regular over-the-counter Crest fluoride kind of thing. And I was being a consumer of that kind of product for 30 years, just concerned. And so I haven't experienced really any significant difference in switching, which I think is actually a good thing. I don't want to have that sound come off like a negative, but I kind of was concerned that in switching that maybe my teeth would begin to hurt or they would begin to, like Trina said, not be as white or maybe my breath wouldn't be as fresh, but I haven't experienced any of those problems. And I'm hoping that over time by using this clay-based toothpaste that maybe this cavity that was kind of in a stasis before might be inclined to remineralize. I don't know, you know, how much I support the idea of that happening and completion of healing this cavity that I've had for a couple of years. But I do know that if bones can heal in the body with excess, well, not excess, with proper nutrients, then the idea to me that teeth could heal seems feasible. And I do know that that's, you know, where the Weston A. Price Foundation started their journey, is in proper teeth care and trying to figure out how to optimize mouth health, I think they call it. And so just, it's a really interesting topic to me personally. And it's also something that, because I have three kids, I'm interested to figure out. I know that they're swallowing toothpaste. Like, I just, even though they're taught to spit, they're 2 and 5 and 7 and they swallow things. So, we switched them to a Tom's brand, but it still it has less fluoride, but it still has fluoride. So, I don't know that I'm any more clear than I than before, but at least now I have information, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Liz is like the bone health.
Yeah. Yeah. She's been pretty quiet. Did she get carried away in her
storm?
Yeah. The rainstorm has carried me away. I've been muted. I think that, I'm really into, you know, I really got into the whole fat soluble vitamin thing. Because on my whole journey to, you know, recover from acne and deal with eczema and all that good stuff. But the cool thing about fat-soluble vitamins is that they actually are super important in structural health. So whether we're talking about the bones or the teeth or whatever, we're actually looking at vitamins A, D, and K2. And people are really... Diane and I had a podcast with Chris Masterjohn recently, and we were talking about this mainstream obsession with vitamin D and getting vitamin D levels up and how that's so important. But the truth is, you can't talk about one vitamin in isolation when it comes to structural health, bones, teeth, whatever. Because vitamin D is also important to dental health, but you can't talk about vitamin D without also talking about vitamin A and vitamin K2. Because what happens is you get one, which, you know, none of these nutrients occur in isolation in nature. These things all are supposed to occur together, and they occur together for a reason. But what vitamin D does, like overdosing on vitamin D, you know, folks that are trying to get their bones healthy with that, they're actually probably setting the stage for some soft tissue calcification. And in the future, you know, you were talking, Sarah, about how these things are long-term. These aren't things that we necessarily see the consequences of right away, but down the road, I think we're going to see a lot of people who have kind of thrown themselves into an entire other imbalance trying to do something good for their structural health. But what's really important about getting vitamins A, D, and K2 together is that they actually basically activate receptor sites. They basically turn on kind of the physiology that's necessary to build and maintain and remodel healthy bone, healthy teeth, and all that good stuff. So that's just part and parcel to a really nutrient dense, you know, traditional diet where you're eating stuff like liver and the odd bits and cod liver oil and all that good stuff. So
lard, good source of vitamin D.
Exactly. So that's from the inside. That's kind of a perspective from, you know, inside out. Trina's definitely got the outside in covered with her tooth powder and serum, gum serum and all that good stuff. So,
and I do agree with you, Liz, 100%. It cannot just be, what you put on. You have to feed the body the correct nutrients, the appropriate vitamins, in order to get a complete healthy body.
So I will sum up this segment by saying that I personally have switched toothpaste, but the rest of my family has not. And if I go back to the dentist a year from now and my x-ray is smaller, I have a smaller cavity than when I went in, then I personally will be switching over the family. And I think everyone just needs to do what they're comfortable with, knowing that none of us are medical professionals and advising you in some sort of way other than just to share some fascinating information.
For sure.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Maybe we should do a couple of questions before we wrap up the show.
Good idea.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
First question was from Josie, who actually sent a direct email to Matt and Stacey and wrote, love your blog and just bought Eat Like a Dinosaur. Stacey.
Thanks, Josie. Yeah, I think we told her that, but if not, thank you.
Way to you, due to our son's tooth decay, he's 27 months. As a result, we have been grain-free for 5 weeks now. We are still eating raw dairy as it is one of the big recommendations for healing tooth decay. He is still breastfeeding and prior to the switch had goat milk, butter, and yogurt. He has unfortunately developed horrible eczema since we started on grain-free, which is leading us to panic. It's been such a big deal. Any advice would be welcome.
So it's interesting to me that his eczema developed when they took out grains. I mean, I would be interested to hear from Josie what else might have happened at the same time. Usually people don't remove one component of a diet without doing some other things as well. If nothing else, I would assume that, and I'm sure Liz can give some backup on this, that the gut health bacteria balance was probably disrupted in some way when those grains were taken out. And ultimately that's for the good because it was probably, like a chronic kind of problem that maybe wasn't showing. And then when you take grains out, those nasty bacteria, maybe they got disrupted in some way and have formed in this manifestation that can be seen. I would say for 2 years old, however, in my personal experience with my middle child who has drastic skin problems, that the most effective things for his skin have been the removal of dairy and nightshades, and we moderate nuts for him. So that would be tomatoes, peppers, mainly for kids. They're not really interested in hot chilies, and my kids don't like eggplants, and we don't eat white potatoes. Those would be the other nightshades, but it specifically meant taking out peppers and tomatoes from his diet. And then we did do like a transition of higher grade milk, which it sounds like she's doing with the raw milk and the goat milk, but I found that his skin saw drastic and immediate improvement the first week after, maybe just like 3 or 4 days after we went clean with no dairy, we saw really awesome stuff. And I know that we can all talk to different things in a diet that can assist with tooth decay that isn't necessarily raw dairy. That's not the only place that you can find those nutrients which are beneficial. Liz, you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't do a whole lot of work with kids just because I'm the only one here who does not have a little bit of a brood. And it's just like, man, they're so little. And I don't know. So, but if I were speaking to an adult or if I were, you know, thinking about this, for my own family, I would probably, like you said, Stacey, as nourishing as I think certain types of milk, like raw grass fed, you know, from certain types of cows, as nourishing as I think that can be. And it's a great source of, you know, calcium, minerals, fat-soluble vitamins. I think that if you're really, like we like to talk about, seeking nutrients, number one, and not just subtracting foods, because it's great to get rid of gluten and grains and all that good stuff. I will throw in that, like you said, maybe there's something else going on here, a stressor that has caused an eczema flare-up, but eczema is usually tied to some kind of digestive issue, as you pointed out. So maybe this is a stressful time and it's triggered something, but going back to really seeking nutrients, looking at, okay, well, if we're having this allergic reaction and milk is a common culprit for this type of thing, pull out that dairy, or like you said, try something else, maybe try some goat's milk or something like that. I know goat's milk actually has some different constituents that may make it less beneficial for kids. Like I said, I'm not super tuned in on why, I guess, cow's milk is supposed to be better for kids. I don't know. I'm getting into rough territory there, but definitely you can actually check out the goat's milk, cow's milk stuff at the Weston A. Price Foundation website. I think they explain that over there. But back to my point, seeking nutrients, if you're looking for those important minerals and vitamins, kids, it's absolutely appropriate to give kids bone broth, which is really dense in calcium and other good cofactors for calcium absorption and retention and utilization. Egg yolks are rich in choline and vitamin A. Liver is rich in everything you could possibly need. Liver is great for kids. Fermented cod liver oil for those fat-soluble vitamins. That's where the nutrition is. It's great that we've, you know, pulled out grains. That's probably going to take care of some malabsorption issues. It's really, really important. But from there, you have to go and really seek those nutrients in their most, you know, bioavailable, non-allergenic form. And that's what I would do. I think that gut dysbiosis is probably something to think about. That can definitely manipulate how nutrients are absorbed and utilized. So that's kind of what's floating around in my head with regards to that question.
I think gut dysbiosis is probably a really good idea for Josie to look into, specifically because she's mentioned he had tooth decay, which indicates to me that he probably was eating a higher sugar diet, or for whatever reason, his body wasn't processing whatever sugars he was getting, because at 27 months to have tooth decay is pretty intense. And I would imagine that it was doing something intense to his innards as well.
I would probably actually seek out a practitioner for that, an enlightened practitioner, because it's really, you know, not something that I've found a whole lot of encouraging work kind of in the mainstream medical field. There are those standard approaches, but you know, I really like, he's not cheap, but I really like Dr. Ron Schmid. You can find him over at drrons.com, and you can sometimes submit a question that they'll reply to and give a quick answer, a quick rundown via email for free. So she might go over to drrons.com and just inquire. Yeah.
And I'll ask Matt to put in the show notes, but we have a recipe for egg drop soup on our site that our kids love for breakfast, and that has the bone broth and pastured egg yolks in it. That would be just as much of a boost as raw milk or something, like Liz said, with the nutrients. Trina or Sarah, you guys good? You want
to? The only thing I'd like to include is I do agree, dairy, 100%. I know I get eczema, and so do my kids, from dairy. And we also get it from raw dairy. So just because, like, you know, you think – there is a difference between the raw and regular dairy, and goat's milk as well. We are allergic to all three of those. But also to look at your surroundings as well, because eczema is not just internal. It can be from external, including any kind of synthetic fragrances or any kind of creams or lotions that they might be using. If they have a synthetic fragrance, that could be causing some sort of reaction, as well as cleaning products and natural household products like your laundry detergent as well. And healing oils are amazing for them, including emu oil and tamanu oil. Those are the two best oils, I think, that help with eczema.
Is emu oil actually the fat from emus?
It is. It's wonderful. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's not vegan, but it is paleo. 100%. It's so healing. It's that tamanu and emu are two of my favorite oils to use.
Do you have a good source for emu oil, Trina? I have one in the Skintervention guide that's New Zealand, sourced from New Zealand, which is a pretty trustworthy source, but I didn't know if you had one that you'd recommend to folks.
I do. It's Four Star Emu Ranch. And yes, that's a very good source.
Awesome.
We'll try to get that in the show notes.
I would add is that to have a look at what foods that they've replaced grains with that he might be eating a lot more of, because eczema, it could just be a general gut health issue, but it's also very likely a food sensitivity issue. So I know that my youngest daughter gets eczema from strawberries. She gets hives from tomatoes. And she also, let her eat a lot of oranges, like if she has one orange, she's usually okay. But if she eats a lot of oranges, she'll sometimes, get some eczema as well. So to look at, especially the high allergy foods that are left in his diet. So that would be things like citrus, latex allergy foods like bananas, eggs are a really common culprit. I mean, as healthful as pastured egg yolks are, you know, unfortunately, eggs are also still a high allergy food. Fish and shellfish are the other sort of big high allergy food if he's eating a lot of that. So, you know, maybe if you're going to be seeking out a practitioner to be evaluating gut health, doing a food allergy and food sensitive blood panel would probably be a good thing to ask for as well. Okay, so we only have time for one more question, but it's a good one. It's from Tammy from Seal Beach, California. First, a comment. Sarah, you mentioned in one of your podcasts that you had a bad reaction when you reintroduced chocolate into your diet. I think I might have talked about that today, actually. I've had similar issues, but found out it was the soy lecithin in my dark chocolate which caused the problems. Same with egg yolk. Has to be soy-free for me. Also, all my cream and butter, even ghee, has to be grass-fed, otherwise I react. Fortunately, I have a woman to go to for nutritional help. She looks at my blood through a microscope and then has me hold various items while she checks to see if my pulse rate responds. This is how I initially found out I was gluten and soy sensitive. She tested me for corn. Even organic corn was no good. Then I brought in some blue corn and I was fine with it. I was fine with grapefruit and limes, but not lemons or oranges. Isn't that weird? Oh, well, now for my question. I'd like to know if you have any ideas about why my nails, much more soft and splitting, my hair, much more dry and falling out, skin, from clear to breakouts on face, especially neck and cheeks, and bowel movements, more constipated, would take a turn for the worse after going paleo. Is this just my body trying to get cleaned out and regulated to the new meat-heavy diet? My diet is clean now, except for some occasional, once or twice a week, dark, soy-free, organic chocolate. I don't do paleo treats or questionable foods. Been following your recommendations from the podcast. Keep up the good work.
I'll let you ladies take this one.
This is the type of stuff that we cover a lot in the Skin Intervention Guide. I mean, this just kind of screams digestive help needed. And, you know, that basically means help with absorption, digestion, assimilation of the nutrients that are used as building blocks for healthy hair, healthy skin, teeth, nails, all that good stuff. So, you know, you can kind of read the nails and the hair and all that stuff for, you know, what you're quote unquote missing. But, and this is really hard too, because it's like people say they're eating clean and they're not doing treats, but there's a ton of different stuff, you know, at work, what you were eating before and what paleo means to you and what kind of nutrients you're actually taking in. One of the biggest pitfalls that I see is people focusing so much on like muscle meat, and there's nothing wrong with meat. Meat is a perfectly nutritious thing to eat, but what we know is that the nutrition that's present in kind of the fattier cuts of grass-fed meat is actually really, really important for digestion and for the whole kind of physical health of your body. So you actually want to look at getting some good, like glycine-rich meats, like some of that connective tissue, some of that good stuff that you also find like in bone broth and in gelatin, that type of thing is really important, not just for helping you digest and assimilate the nutrition in meat, but it's also really important for healing your digestive tract in the first place. So once again, it's not like you have to go start chucking a bunch of supplements down to help get adjusted to a new diet, but you have to really look at incorporating those nutrient-rich foods like the bone broth, the cod liver oil, all that good stuff, and kind of expanding your repertoire rather than saying, okay, well, this isn't paleo, so I'm just going to keep eating chicken breast, or I'm just going to keep eating, you know, 99% lean beef and just move away from the grains, if that makes sense. So that's really my read here. I mean, you guys have any thoughts on that?
This is Stacey. My only add is I would say that the trigger for me in this, as she said, in the newly meat heavy diet. And I know Sarah, you and I have talked about before also that, paleo is not a meat only diet, that it's really important that people are eating lots of bright and colorful, happy vegetables and fruits, and making sure that you're getting all those vitamins and minerals. And so, like you said, Liz, from sounds like a malabsorption of nutrients, and maybe in fact, she's not even getting as many nutrients as she needs if she's not eating a, you know, colorful spectrum of vitamins from, vegetables and fruit.
So there's also, I mean, I guess the hair and nails thing makes me think of thyroid issues. And there's a few ways that people often implement a paleo diet, especially when they're first starting, that can be really hard on the thyroid. One is going to low carbohydrate. So a very low carbohydrate diet is really, really hard on the thyroid gland. You actually require insulin in order to convert the pro-hormone T4 into the active hormone T3, thyroid hormone. So that doesn't mean, hot dysregulated blood sugars and high blood sugars are also really, really hard on the thyroid and can cause thyroid problems. But going too low carbohydrate, which a lot of people do, especially when she says meat heavy diet, that makes me wonder if she's eating enough vegetables and maybe incorporating some starchy vegetables and or some fruit into her diet. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that some people do when they go paleo is they go really no salt, or they go completely sea salt, like the just non-iodized sea salt. And I would recommend looking at either dirty sea salt or Himalayan pink salt, because they have a really high amount of trace minerals, including iodine, which... if thyroid issues are sort of borderline before paleo, then between potentially not getting enough dietary iodine and going too low carb, that could be, pushing sort of things over the edge for her thyroid through that transition, especially if she's not digesting her food properly. So looking at digestive support supplements would also be the other thing that I would recommend.
Gina, do you have recommendations for while she's healing, or any other thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are this, and a lot of times people switch their diet and they get this euphoric feeling that I'm clean today. I've been clean for a week. Everything is just wonderful, but they forget that they've been eating a toxic type diet with chemicals and preservatives for the past maybe 20 years or longer, maybe shorter. But for the most part, you've been eating that for years and years. And those toxins mm-hmm. and chemicals and all those things go somewhere in your body. They are not all just broken down and eliminated. And they like to be stored in the fat. So as you switch to a healthy diet that has no toxins, no chemicals, no hormones, you still have to understand that you still have the results of your previous diet in you. And it can take up to 6 months for those toxins to work their way out of your fat tissue and be eliminated. They're stored in all types of tissue. Fat is what they love, but they store in your gut. They store in your liver, in your lungs, and they are broken down by your liver. But they are eliminated not just through your liver, but they are eliminated in your kidneys and your skin. So some of the skin conditions that she's mentioning could just be a reaction or a detox and an adjustment. Because even if you've never been constipated before in your life, this could be just a symptom of a detox. Your body's going to go through various adjustments in the time that you change your diet, and it can change, including up to 6 months after you start your new diet. And someone that's never had constipation, diarrhea, acne, rosacea, eczema, dehydration could all of a sudden develop these at various times and intermittently. It could go away and then come back. So she just has to stick with it. And like Liz said, you've got to heal the body, but the healing takes place, but you don't see it. You don't always feel it. But sometimes it does take some time. It can take 6 months or longer to completely heal. That's called.
Fabulous. Any final thoughts before we wrap up, ladies?
I wanted to point out that Trina is also in the field of anesthesiology, and she is an absolute genius with, how detox works. And sometimes we think of detox as kind of a hippy dippy term, but it's really not. And that's something that Trina really helped me solidify mentally, is feeling okay talking about detox and how that actually works, because it's a very real thing.
Yes. Thanks, Liz. And you can read, I wrote an article recently, because as people have been going through the Skin Intervention Guide and doing all these great things, we started getting hit with, why is this happening? Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know what, I need to get out there and reach out to people, let them know that what they're feeling is actually real and it's normal and you have to go through that. So don't give up, because once you get past that, things will be better. But there is that detox and adjustment period. But you can read it at cavegirlskincare.com, which is my blog. You can also find it on my website.
We'll make sure to put a – we. Matt will make sure to put a link in the show notes. Poor guy. Cool. Well, I just adore you both, and I appreciate you taking the time. I know, Liz, you're in the midst of many, many things in your personal life, but it was great to have you on and always good to talk to you. So yes. Everybody make sure you check out Liz can be found at cavegirleats.com. Her skin intervention guide, we'll put links in the show notes, and her modern cave girl book comes out maybe May, maybe later, but definitely coming, and it will be worth the wait. And
I promise.
Trina, I'm sorry, I don't know the name of your blog, but I do know people can find you at Primal Life Organics, and we'll put a link in the show notes. You want to mention it one more time for people?
My blog is cavegirlskincare.com.
Awesome. Well, great. Thank you so much for coming on. And I personally have learned a lot about taking care of the outside of my body as well as the inside of my body from both of you. And I'm hoping that this can be a little bit of a start for other people to think about doing some of that themselves. So
thank you so much. I enjoyed it. This was fun.
That was fun. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Awesome. Have a good one, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
La 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 la.